Discover how to have a more playful life. The Playful Life Podcast, here we go. With Anthony Traher as your host. Discover how to have a more playful life. The Playful Life Podcast, here we go. With Anthony Traher as your host.
Hello, everybody. So welcome back to the Playful Life Podcast. And today I'm very happy to have a guest from America, from North America, Shelley Johnson. And Shelley's she's a philosopher of play, and I interview or go deeply into Shelley's work, and I came across I was looking for the connection between play and perfectionism. I woke up one morning and thought, wait, that's like, playfulness is definitely like a cure for perfectionism, and that's like plaguing like modern society, right? This whole concept. And I came across your article on the Tiny Buddha, and I just thought it was so good. It really hit the nail on the head for me. So so before I go into that, just welcome Shelley. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Yeah. So let me just read this passage on this post. It's, unfortunately, my attitude began shifting from playfulness to perfectionism early on. Instead of being present and enjoying the process, I started focusing on performance, mainly impressing people, and product, doing everything right. The more I did this, the less open, curious, and joyful I was. So let's just start diving in there. Unpack this a little bit for me.
Sure.
Perfectionism, playfulness.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So how about if I start talking a little bit about how I started off playful and then became perfectionistic? Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, great. Well, so I might have mentioned this in the article. I mentioned this on my blog. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, and that was just a pivotal experience for me. I guess I should say an incredibly formative experience for me. And I guess the reason I found it so formative is that I was really lucky to, although I lived in an urban environment, I lived in Portland, I went to a lovely public school that really emphasized play a lot. And these folks were serious about play. So for instance, I kid you not, we did a lot of things on in recess that would be considered today risky play. For instance, they had stilts and unicycles for us. I remember us having these inner tubes, big inner tubes that were kind of really bouncy, and we'd roll down the hill on them. We had these bars that we could do these kind of acrobatic swinging things on. And then in recess or gym, because we had gym a lot, they bought all these roller skates, used roller skates from a roller skating rink, and we did roller skating units. And so I had this incredibly playful growing up. I spent a lot of time outside. And then there was this beautiful camp in nearby Chehalem Valley, a day camp that I went to in the summer. It's called Tillicum. It's a lovely camp. And I love to give a shout out for Tillicum whenever I can. Anyhow, I grew up in the forests. I grew up playing. I grew up being outside. I grew up being curious about how I could try new things and learn and expand my physical capabilities. I did a lot of drawing and writing, climbing trees, all these things. Okay. So needless to say, I feel so grateful for that experience because I seriously had the idea growing up that life was like an adventure. And I was like, oh, I'm excited to grow. You know, I'm excited to wake up and try the next day because it's an adventure and you never know what's going to happen. And that's how I approached life. And it wasn't that my life was perfect, because it wasn't, but those playful experiences really form this adventurous view towards life. But, you know, as I got older, and I think this happens to a lot of us, there was less and less emphasis on free play and exploring our environment and kind of taking an adventurous attitude towards life. And it's partly my personality. I want to be very honest about that. But then partly just the pressures of growing up, I suddenly felt like I was pressured to perform a lot. Like, I have to do well in school, and I have to do well on extracurricular activities, and I have to make everybody like me, and, you know, I have to look good. And this was partially being a woman growing up in the United States, which is a lovely, it's a lovely country in so many ways, but the dark side of it is that it can be very competitive and pressureful sometimes. So anyhow, as I felt those pressures piling up on me, I found myself being less and less playful, because to be honest, I just felt like that there was less and less room for making mistakes and just approaching the world with a sense of adventure and enjoying it for its own sake. It seemed like everything that I was doing had to be sent for something else, like achieving something or impressing other people. And that really started to cultivate this attitude of perfectionism.
Yeah. It's really this, when people I find start to discover playfulness and they're like introduced to it, they're amazed that you can actually do something just for the joy of it. It blows them away. You know, it's like, what you mean? I can do this just because I like to do it.
Right.
Yeah. So please go a little bit more into this, into your story, Shelley.
Sure. Well, so perhaps the second act of this story is the act in which my perfectionism escalated to the point that it caused me an emotional crisis. And you know what? I don't need to go into all the details of that, because the details aren't extremely important. But the details I can tell you is that I was a young professional. I really cared about my job. I was a teacher, actually, in middle and high school for a lot of years. I really cared about my job. I cared about doing it well. You know, in my defense, I really felt like my job was one of the most important jobs in the world. I was training students, you know, to be the future leaders of the world. But the problem, once again, is that even though I still maintained a lot of playfulness in my approach towards life, that perfectionism, especially in how I viewed myself and the expectations of myself, that became the dominant theme of my life. And the way that that expressed itself is, for example, there were a couple of things. If I made even the smallest mistake, I would agonize about it. I would ruminate about it. I was somebody, and I think a lot of people are this way, I would apologize for things all the time that, like, I just didn't need to apologize for them. I was a human being making mistakes. But for me, a mistake kind of felt like a death sentence. A mistake to me felt like, oh man, I'm letting people down. I'm letting myself down. I'm ruining people's lives. I'm proving to people that I am not worthy of respect or belonging or love or that sort of thing. And just increasingly, I had very little, if any, room for just allowing myself to be a human being, for just allowing myself to try new things and learn new things, make mistakes and grow from them. And I think I did still grow a lot, but in as much as I was a perfectionist, it actually kept me from trying new things. Or if I did try new things and I made mistakes, I often got locked in these cycles of shame, regret, rumination, anxiety, that when really, if I had not been perfectionistic, or just caught in that web of perfectionism, I could have looked at these mistakes, become curious and said, wow, that really didn't work out. Like, that did not go how I thought it was going to go. Why is that? I wonder what I could learn from that. And then I could have moved on and I could have grown and I could have brought more joy into my life and other people's life. I guess we'll kind of segue from the second act to the third act, and you feel free to interrupt me at any time, Anthony.
I wanted to just put this in there a second. So there's also a lot tied up with the word perfect. I feel, you know, we say, I want this to be perfect. I want this. I think we can also even just like start to change the way we use our words. We can start to change our experience totally, right?
Yes, so, yes, that's right.
But I want to talk about this a little bit more once you finish this story. So the third act.
Yeah, so the third act. so eventually I ran myself into the ground. I caused myself severe anxiety and exhaustion. And I was very fortunate. I did kind of have a crash. I think of it as a crash, and I was still able to go to work, amazingly. But honestly, to be honest, I came home for 2 or 3 years straight after work and laid on the couch and was depressed. I probably should have. I didn't seek out counseling at this point. So I don't know how depressed I was, or you know, if somebody had diagnosed me. But I do know that I just laid on the couch for a lot of years, thinking about my thoughts were, life is miserable. I am miserable. I actually thought at this time, I will never be happy again. And in fact, I told my husband that, and I felt that. I said, I will never be happy again. And that was shocking to me, because if you knew me growing up and if you know me now, I tend to be a fairly cheerful person. Like, I have bad days like everybody, but I guess I have what some people would call a sunny disposition. But man, I really did a number on myself with perfectionism, and I really thought that I would never be happy again. And that signaled to me, like, I just need to look at life differently. I knew that there was something wrong with how I was looking at life. It was, you know, people kind of talk about hitting rock bottom, and I want to be careful about saying that, because, you know, sometimes when people hit rock bottom, they really hit rock bottom. Like, it's a really desperate time in their life. And I guess from the outside, my situation might not have looked desperate, but it felt desperate to me. Right. So yeah, to make a long story short, number one, I knew that I was looking at life wrong somehow, or not wrong. I just knew it. I like the word unskillfully. I knew that there was a way that I was looking at life unskillfully, because I think when we get hung up on right and wrong, we often shame ourselves. But if we use the phrase or the word skillful or unskillful, we can just say, hey, something isn't working with what I'm doing right now. How could I do things differently? And about this time, I had a good friend that I worked with. She's just a lovely person. So I'm going to give a shout out to Amy. And Amy and I discovered that there was a fencing class at a local YMCA. And I had always wanted to take fencing. So her and I signed up for that. And you know what? I was not going to go to the Olympics to be a fencer. Like, that was not my goal. I mean, in some ways, fencing might seem like a pretty useless art, because, you know, the chances of you having a fencing foil on hand if somebody attacks you are not very, not very high. So I say all this to say that there's some ways where it can seem like fencing is kind of useless. But I don't think that's the case. So for all you fencers out there, I think it's a beautiful sport. But I just took fencing because I just wanted to take fencing. There was no other reason for it besides just that I wanted to do it. And Amy and I went every week. I remember us doing this for like maybe 4 or 5 months, and we had an amazing time. And I was still at my job, which, you know what, was in many ways a lovely job, but which I just felt like I didn't know what to do, but I felt something awaken in me. And it was like the playfulness that I started to cultivate in my fencing lessons helped me detach from the deep sense of sadness that I felt in my life. And I don't want to state this negatively, but it was almost like I developed this attitude of, you know what? I just don't care. And it's not that I didn't care, because I did. I cared about my life. I cared about my work. But my attitude of I don't care, that was actually the first time that I had really ever said that in my adult life. And to me, it signaled to me, Shelly, you do not have to take life so seriously. Not everything you do has to be about you proving your worth and achieving some amazing goal. Like, you can just detach from this situation that you find yourself in, and in a sense, not care about the outcome. And when I say I don't care, that doesn't mean that I was giving myself an excuse to, for instance, be lazy or to be cruel to people or to sabotage my colleagues. No, that's not. It was more just me recognizing it's okay for me to let go of how this turns out and to just be in the moment right now and to enjoy being playful and curious, and to recognize that that's actually the most important thing about life, is being playful and curious and open. And I might have messed up the labeling of these acts because I almost feel like maybe the next, I don't know what act the next act is, but I can tell you about how this new attitude helped me if you want to learn, but or if you want to know. But
sure. Yeah, let us not worry about these acts. I think that's... Yeah, totally. Let's continue.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just call this the fourth act for the sake of continuity. Okay. So eventually, and it wasn't just my fencing that caused this. It was a combination of my crisis, the fencing, and just some other things that I started going through in my life. And eventually I realized, you know, I love my job in so many ways, but it's time for me to go on, and because I really need to explore the world in some ways that I'm just not able to now, not because of anything wrong with where I was, but because I just needed to move on to a new phase of my life. So to make a long story short, I decided through a chain of events that I needed to go back and study philosophy and get my PhD in philosophy. And that's actually a whole nother story, because that was that was quite the decision in itself. But I'll tell you what, Anthony, this playful attitude that I started to cultivate, which was an attitude part of curiosity, of joy, adventure, and detachment, it saved me in graduate school. And I could tell you so many ways that it saved me, but I'll give you a quick example. So I did not do my undergrad in philosophy. I was an English and education major. So somehow I thought it was a good idea, and it was, but it sounded crazy. I thought it was a good idea just jump into philosophy after having taken one class in undergrad and like auditing a few other ones. And I had a rough time at the beginning. Like, on the one hand, I loved it. I thrived. I loved being in that environment. And I love philosophy so much, I can barely stand it. But because I had not taken philosophy as an undergrad, I had a big learning curve. And that really became apparent to me when I started taking our department's comprehensive exams, which we had to take to be able to teach as a TA, as a teaching assistant, and to get our master's degree on our way to our PhD. Well, to make a long story short, we were allowed to fail them twice. I think we were allowed to fail them twice. There were two exams with a long list of questions and a huger list of books, of the hardest textbooks you've ever, or philosophy books you've ever read, like Aristotle's Metaphysics, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, Hegel's Phenomenology, you know, all these books. And I was a really diligent student, But I failed those tests, both of them, the first time. And I was devastated at first. And I started worrying, thinking, golly, maybe I am not cut out for this program. But you know what? That was not it. It was that I had a learning curve. It was that I needed to just spend a little bit of time more with these ideas. So it suddenly occurred to me, I need to adopt this playful attitude towards life. Like, I need to detach from the outcome. It's not really important what the outcome is. Like, of course I want to pass these tests, but I need to treat this as an adventure. And so I did. And I began treating it that way. And honestly, I started visualizing passing the comps like a target that I was shooting an arrow into. And my goal was to just get closer and closer to the bullseye. So I said to myself, you know what, look, it doesn't matter if I get exactly in the bullseye. My goal is to get as close to as I can to the bullseye. And every time I take these tests, even if I fail them, I am going to see if I can get myself closer to the bullseye. And that really helped me. And then I just, you know, tried to remain open and ask myself, that test didn't go quite as I wanted it to. What could I do? Like, how could I help myself? Is there anything else I could do? And you know what? I did things like I got some tutoring or some help from colleagues and professors. I changed my approach to how I studied. And to make a long story short, I ended up passing them. And that playful attitude saved me, because if I had been stuck in my perfectionism that I had, that was so entrenched in my life before, I would have started shaming myself and saying things like, you are so dumb. What's wrong with you? Why can't you pass these? Like, this is a clear sign that you don't belong here. But none of that was true. And so that playfulness allowed me to adopt the attitude I needed to be able to pass. And I did. And I went on. And honestly, that was the hardest part of my program. You would think writing my dissertation was hard. I found those comps to be the hardest. And I don't know if I want to quite say the rest was smooth sailing, but it was relatively smooth sailing compared to those tests. And so I graduated and got my doctorate and PhD. And I now teach philosophy at a local college. And I really do my best to cultivate that same playful attitude with my students, because I know that that is what's going to help them to be able to do well in philosophy. And, you know, Socrates said himself that philosophy begins in wonder. I believe it's the Theaetetus, the dialogue where Socrates says that. And I might be messing up the character. It might be another character who says that. But that's the idea. Philosophy begins in wonder. And I actually think that kind of life begins in wonder too. So maybe I'll end my story there and let you ask some other questions.
Brilliant, Shelley. So there's definitely a lot there. So let ourselves and our listeners just take that all in a moment.
Sure.
So of course, you know, when we listen to anybody's story, the questions that come to ourselves is, how is this relevant to my life?
Yes.
So we all know this feeling of wanting to get something done well. We all know this feeling of being worried about something. I'm not so sure we all know this feeling about coming home from work and like being on the couch and not wanting to get up. But I've got a feeling lots of people know this feeling.
Yes.
So you did talk about it a lot. I would like to just like dive in a tiny bit more. So it was, how did this sort of feeling of wanting to go fencing emerge in you? You know, I think this passage is important, because I think it's there that this transformation happened.
Yes. Yes, that's a good question. I like that insight. So here's how I think it happened. And I hope this might be encouraging to some people, especially those who either are in a place like I was, where they feel like I will never be happy again or something like that. Or they're just having a rough time and they think, yeah, I need a new view of life. So here's how I think the passage happened. The passage where it actually, I'm going to say it was an awakening. An awakening happened. I think that I was able to awaken And that all of us have the capability to awaken, because you know what, Anthony? I think this play drive is the natural drive of human beings. I think it is what is underlying and is I almost want to say the word primal in us. I think that's right. That's not a word that I use a lot in connection with play. I will tell you that there are a lot of philosophers, and I won't get into that now, who write that play is the primary drive or one of the primary drives of human beings. And so I think that when I was lying on my couch, feeling like I would never be happy again, and then I said to myself, this is not working. I have got to have a different view of life. That was just the spark that I needed, the question that I needed, or the observation that I needed to let that original drive that's in me and everyone to surface. And I can't remember if I had heard about fencing before I had this, or if me saying I need to find a different way to live somehow prompted me to seek out activities that would help me feel different. I don't know. I know that both of those things have happened to me before. So sometimes when I feel really stuck in perfectionism, which still happens to me sometimes, and I need a different way to live or a different way to think, I will sometimes ask myself, like, well, what would help me feel different? How do I want to feel? What would help me feel different? What kind of activity might lead the way to that kind of feeling that I wanted? And honestly, I think I was wanting to feel curiosity and joy and enchantment and wonder again. And I knew that it was like what I felt when I was a child, growing up in Oregon. And whether fencing came before or after that, I mean, like whether I knew about fencing already or the search for those feelings caused me to seek fencing out, I think it was my observation of my suffering, my deciding that I needed to live differently and I could live differently, and then thinking about how I wanted to live and kind of accessing the memory of those feelings of joy and wonder. That's how I think my awakening happened.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. I know in lots of acting schools, they use fencing for presence.
Interesting.
There's lots of fencing training. But for me, for example, it was juggling that really completely changed everything for me, right?
Yes.
And I don't juggle very much nowadays, but I had a juggle this morning. You know, I worked in a garden for 3 hours. Also, gardening I find very grounding. I mean, it's like a play on words, right? Because it's the ground. Yes. But I had a juggle after that, and it just felt so good, really. And I'm 48 now, and I learned to juggle 26 years. No, much longer ago. Nearly 30 years ago, I learned to juggle, right? Wow. And it's so much in my brain and just wakens up this joy. And
yes.
Yeah. So, I would like to go a little bit more into the philosophy of play. In an earlier podcast, we had a conversation with Marik de Long, and she's from the Netherlands. And we talked there a lot about philosophy and play and about try and define seriousness, try and define playfulness. So there was a lot about trying to define things, right? But yes. Somehow I'd like to, if you could, Shelley, like try and make it as practical as possible. But anyway, your insights on the philosophy of play.
Yes. There is so much there. I love this question because I love the philosophy of play. And just for a little bit of context, at the college where I teach, last semester, I taught an honors reading group on the philosophy of play. And it was wonderful because we would come, we would discuss philosophy of play, and then we would play for 15 or 20 minutes at the end of class. And we played with parachute, we juggled, we played with poi. And the goal was just to have fun. And it was amazing. It was really life-changing for me. I think maybe it was for some of my students too, but I think a good way for me to just make this very practical while still tying it to philosophy is to tell you, this might surprise everybody, did you know that there is actually a virtue of playfulness? Aristotle talks about it in Nicomachean Ethics. Please don't worry, any folks listening who have had bad experiences with philosophy, I will not make this confusing, at least that's my goal. So the virtue of play for Aristotle is called eutrapelia. It is actually a virtue. It's the virtue of playfulness. It's sometimes called wittiness. Isn't that a beautiful word, eutrapelia? Yeah. And just briefly, let me tell you a few things about eutrapelia. So eutrapelia, if you look at the original etymology, just means something like the well-turning soul, like a soul that is able to, a spirit that is able to go lightly about the world. Maybe I started to demonstrate this when I started becoming a little bit more detached from things and saying, look, I don't have to worry about the outcome. I can just be present in the moment. Well, here's one other thing that you should know about eutrapelia, maybe two other things. Aristotle tells us that eutrapelia is a midpoint between two extremes we want to avoid. One extreme is something that Aristotle calls the bomolikos. And the bomolikos, the word that you're probably familiar with it, is the buffoon. It's somebody who's always constantly joking, especially at inappropriate times, and can never take life seriously, and never is maybe following through on responsibilities or looking at what they need to do, or they're always making a joke about something, again, even at inappropriate times. But the other extreme to that, that Aristotle tells us we have to avoid, is the person he calls an egregious. An egregious is a boorish person. That's the word that we might be familiar with. And honestly, when I was stuck in perfectionism, I tended towards boorishness, because boorishness occurs when we're taking ourselves so seriously all the time, which I've struggled with my whole life, and everything is so serious, and everything is a life or death matter. And I displayed my boorishness the most when I took every event as an event where I had to prove myself. Okay, well, Aristotle tells us that neither of those extremes are helpful. And actually, neither of those extremes contribute to a healthy spirit, a healthy, flourishing, inner, happy life. So Aristotle tells us that we need to become a eutrapelos. And a eutrapelos demonstrates the virtue of eutrapelia. And the eutrapelos has this well-turning soul and can approach life lightly and with a sense of wittiness and humor without being a buffoon or without being boorish. And I love thinking about that, because I don't know about you, but I think a lot of grownups don't consider playfulness a virtue. They think, no, playfulness is something that children do. But when you get older, you have to leave all that behind and you have to be serious now. And maybe that can kind of make adults become boorish a little bit. And you know what? Frequently, I think that when we leave all play behind, it sets up these wild imbalances in our life. Because guess what? Nobody can exist without play. And when we try to exist without play, and we say, no, play is not for adults, it's for children, we'll be really serious, and then we'll run ourselves into the ground and with exhaustion. And then sometimes we go to the other extreme, where maybe we completely cast off all of our responsibilities, and we get stuck, like I was, just lying on the couch, just exhausted. And by the way, when I say that, that is no judgment for anybody who finds themselves in that condition, because again, I was in that condition for 3 years. But for me, that was a definite result of not realizing that eutrapelia, play, was a crucial part of life, that I had to have it. So maybe the one really practical thing I can say with playfulness is that it's a virtue. And even Aristotle recognizes that it is a crucial part of having a happy, good human life. And there's other things that I could say about the philosophy of play, but maybe I'll pause there to see if you
Brilliant. No, I'm I find that beautiful. And recently, I always forget how to say her name, Lulian. It's one of the eight immortals from the Chinese mythology.
Oh, and, wow. I'm not
she's considered like an embodiment of playfulness, like an traveling musician, street performer. And yeah, that's definitely another point to really, really, really like to dive into that. It's yeah, it's these virtues. You know, these eight immortals, they anyway want to say like the anyway qualities to embody.
Yes, yes. And you know what? I should point out here, your point made me think of this. Sometimes when we hear the word virtue in our modern ears, it almost sounds like scolding. Like maybe we had somebody tell us, you need to be virtuous. And so we kind of have this idea of, oh, like virtuous means being a goody-goody or something like that. But the classical idea of virtue is very different. The classical notion of virtue, and I feel like the Asian philosophies have this idea within their philosophy too. Virtue is like an emotional nutrient, you know, so we understand that nutrients are important in food to help strengthen our bodies. And modern folks like Katie Bowman, I love her work on movement and exercise and play. She's a professor and writer in the United States. She talks about nutritious movement, that movement is actually a nutrient that we need in our life and our bodies. Okay, well, so what I would like to suggest is that virtues are emotional and mental nutrients. And what Aristotle tells us is that virtues are actually character habits that we form when we encounter a certain situation in life and we practice over time developing just the right response to it that has the appropriate amount of reason and emotion in it. And it's something that happens through practice. It's not something that we get right away. We're supposed to look at others, learn from them, practice in our own life. It looks, Aristotle tells us that virtues look different in everybody's life, but he actually compares it, a virtuous person, to a person who has a healthy inner life, like a healthy person who has a healthy, balanced physical body. So I love that because we don't, when we hear, you know, practice the virtue of euterpale or playfulness, that's not something that like a rule we should take to shame ourselves. Rather, it's an invitation to cultivate a character habit that brings a sense of balance into our life and helps us be happy, and that we're supposed to practice and make mistakes and learn how to do it over time.
Yeah, yeah. And going back to what you said, like a really, like, early on in our conversation, asking ourselves better questions, like, already, how can I cultivate that virtue there?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Like, for instance, asking something I've been asking myself, I'm preparing for my semester, and I often get very serious about preparing my syllabi and create all of these standards. And, you know, I am the queen of creating impossible expectations for myself. And so when I find myself getting really stressed out, I start saying to myself, wait a minute, Shelley, if you are stressing yourself out about this, first of all, that's not good for you. But second, you are probably going to stress your students out about this too, and that's not going to help them learn. So how can you be more playful with this? What's a way that you could step back a little bit and be curious and create a space for curiosity and wonder? And whenever I do that, boy, that just really helps me take a different attitude. And often it helps me move through kind of mental barriers I've set up for myself.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, this is definitely lots of inspiring stuff.
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad.
Yeah, I love playfulness, you know, and I really feel it's a life force, like we were saying earlier. It's what I've seen in the playfulness festival that I run is that when we're really in a container that allows us to be ourselves and to play, really our humanity comes out. We become more smiley, we laugh easily, we let go of weights on the shoulders, and I'm biased, right? Because I'm interested in playfulness, but it's our society needs this lightness that it brings. Yeah, us.
We really do. So can I tell you something else that builds on what you just said and might interest you? And this is connected to philosophy of play. Well, so actually I want to tell you two things as I think people might find this really interesting. So I love two things you just said. I love everything you just said, Anthony, but two things that really stood out to me are one, we're most human when we play, and two, our society really needs playfulness. So let me mention two quick ideas in philosophy that might surprise people. They surprised me originally. So there is a man named Hugo Rahner who was a Jesuit priest and writer. And I realize that probably our listeners come from a wide variety of backgrounds, religiously speaking and spiritually speaking. But I think anybody, whether they're religious or not, might find this idea really intriguing. So again, Hugo Rahner's this Jesuit priest and writer. And I don't know about you, but when I hear the phrase Jesuit priest, like I think these people are hardcore, like they are really serious about life. So it might surprise people to know that Hugo Rahner wrote this book called Man at Play, and it's an older book. It was maybe written in the 60s. You can find it on Kindle on Amazon. If you're interested, that's an easy way to find it. But interestingly, Hugo Rahner's whole book, the argument in that whole book, Man at Play, is that human beings are most fully human and godlike when they play, and that in essence, God is the God of play. And in the Catholic and Christian tradition, human beings are made in the image of God. And so when humans play, they're not only most themselves, but they are most godlike too. That blew my mind when I read that originally. But then to your second point that society needs playfulness, there's a Dutch historian named Johan Huizinga. And Johan Huizinga, you might be familiar with this book, wrote the book Homo Ludens, which is playing human being. And his whole argument is that society arises in play and is actually played. So it's not quite right to say that that like society or civilization is a game, but it's almost not, that sounds like it's trivializing civilization. And Huizinga is not trivializing civilization in all its part. Rather, what he's trying to help us understand is that the origins of civilization, like law and government and language and our bodies of knowledge, like philosophy, they actually arose in play, a play moment. And that they, and when they go well, they actually continue in this play moment. And it's actually when people lose the play drive and the play spirit that civilizations begin to crumble and to fall apart and to deteriorate. So I thought you might like to hear those points because there are people writing about exactly the thing you talk about, and it's fascinating.
Yeah. Brilliant. I've a couple more questions. Because like sometimes I sort of almost jokingly say that I find playfulness is like mindfulness and then some.
Yes.
And I just like to hear your thought because there's a connection between the two. It's like playfulness brings us into mindfulness, but also mindfulness, if the whole idea of like playing and trying new things out and being open to being wrong, let's say, and making a mistake is a bit too hard right now, then perhaps mindfulness can be a take us there as a stepping stone. So just like to hear your thoughts around this.
I love that connection. And what I'd like to say real quick is, you know, mindfulness especially grows out of the Buddhist tradition. And I am certainly not a scholar in Buddhist philosophy or Asian and Eastern philosophy, but I have done some work in that. But what I'd like to note is that mindfulness, especially in the Buddhist tradition, is a way that we stay present with ourselves and listening to ourselves and showing kindness and loving compassion to ourselves. And I'll connect this with play in a minute. But let's just note that, you know, there's no way that we can properly care for ourselves if we aren't paying attention to ourselves and listening to ourselves and kind of gently observing what's going on in our life. By the way, I'd like to note, I think there's really no way we can actually play either unless we are present with what we're doing and observing it and being kind and gentle, right? And so I actually love your idea that mindfulness is a way we can get to playfulness. But I would also like to suggest that I actually think that playfulness can also be a way that we get to mindfulness. So I was writing about this the other day on my blog. Pardon me that I keep bringing up my blog. It's just I write about these things a lot.
We'll put a link in the end.
Good.
Check out Shelley's writing.
Oh, please, I would love that. It's Love is Stronger, and you'll see the link. And I do want to note, pardon me for this, a little bit of self-promotion, but I am soon going to be publishing courses on some of these things. So I just want to note that. Right now, there's just primarily blog posts. But anyhow, so I walk a lot. A few years ago, I started walking 10,000 plus steps a day. And I'll tell you what, I like that lit a fire in me, and I just walk now. But part of the reason I do it is because I realized a while ago that being silent, being meditative, being mindful is really helpful for me. It's really helpful for my brain. But I struggle, and it's good for my emotions too. I struggle to sit. So some people do a wonderful job of sitting and meditating and being mindful. I really do much better. It's easier for me to go on walks. And it's the same kind of thing still. I'm present with myself. I'm noticing what's going on with myself. I'm noticing the moment, the beautiful sky and the trees and the birds around me, which is mindfulness. And I find that my playfulness has created a good space for me to be able to do that, but that also my walks help me to be really mindful as well. And so I think that ties into your point, Anthony, that mindfulness can be a good path to playfulness, or vice versa. Playfulness can be a good path to mindfulness. Yeah.
So this is probably my last question now.
Sure.
And what does it mean to be our own best friend?
Yeah. Yes, that's so wonderful that you asked that, because I was just working on kind of editing a post the other day about that. Okay, so do you mind if I answer that question and tie it to playfulness? Would that be a helpful thing?
Of course.
All right. So an idea that has become really important to me in recent years is this idea that every human being is worthy, capable, connected, and called to adventure. Let me focus on that worthiness point, because I believe that it ties to being our own best friend and playfulness as well. So when I say that everybody is worthy, I mean everybody has intrinsic worth. It doesn't mean that we never make mistakes or that we don't ever do bad things. Rather, this idea of intrinsic worth means that all of us have these beautiful seeds of goodness in us, capabilities for creativity, love, wisdom, playfulness, joy, any good thing that you can think about that human beings have ever done. Every single one of us have the seeds of those beautiful things inside of us. And I know that some people, because I've been skeptical of this idea in the past, some people might doubt this, but you might be interested to know, folks listening, and maybe you, Anthony, I don't know. There is modern researcher, Martin Seligman out of the University of Pennsylvania, has done research on character strengths and character virtues. And he has actually documented this through research. Check that out if you'd like. But all these good things that you can think about, that human beings, capabilities they possess, every single person possesses these seeds, and they need to be cultivated and they need to be watered and developed. So I'm going to tie this to your question. What does it mean to be your own best friend? Well, what it means to be your own best friend is to recognize that you yourself possess the most valuable thing already. And so does everybody else. You possess those seeds, again, of love, joy, creativity, wisdom, playfulness, any good thing. And so when we're our own best friend, we first recognize that we have intrinsic worth. I think of that as respect, showing respect to ourselves. Respecting is just honoring that human dignity, that intrinsic worth. Two, it's doing all we can to encourage and water those seeds of goodness in us. And I think of that as kindness. You know, if you think about a person who's really kind, they love to help others and encourage others and build people up. And then the third thing is being our own best friend is showing compassion to ourselves when we have hard times and when we fail and we suffer, because we all inevitably do. And if we take the really perfectionist stance in our life, like I did for so many years, we really struggle showing ourselves compassion when we mess up. Instead, we're really mean to ourselves and we say things like, you're a loser. Like, why can't you do X, Y, Z? But being a friend to ourselves, we recognize, no, wait, all of us suffer. All of us make mistakes. All of us go through hard times. Let's show ourselves compassion. And then let's encourage and remind and build ourselves up that we have intrinsic worth. We're worthy. And we can do it. And we're going to do all we can to nurture those seeds of goodness in us. And that's where the play part comes in. Because when we can get out of that shaming mode where we're really lacking compassion and instead we're kind of beating ourselves over the head for our perceived failures, well, if we can get out of that mode, then we can become playful and we can start dreaming and say, what good things do I want to bring into the world? I call these loving dreams. So our loving dreams are the dreams that bring in more good to our life and the lives of those people around us. So we can start dreaming and then we can get really playful about our dreams, not getting super attached to outcome, but instead approaching the process with wonder and joy and curiosity. And then think of, like, that's us being like our best playmate when we're younger, right? Because isn't this what we do with our best friends when we're younger? Like, we hatch up these schemes together and we're like, yeah, let's go do it. You know? And we kind of just implicitly believe in each other. Like, we're just like, let's go build a tree fort that's a mansion. Yeah, we can do it. Or let's write an entire book about zombies or about bugs. Yeah, we can do it. We kids, when we are little, we are awesome at just believing in our inherent ability to do things and encouraging each other to do it and like going and doing it. And if we fall down while we're doing it, you know, putting our arms around each other and comforting. And I realize kids can be mean sometimes, certainly, but we are geniuses at being good friends to each other. And I think that being a good friend to ourselves is regaining, again, that sense of worthiness, capability, connection, and adventure. That's why we're here. That's where we're on the planet. Really, the whole world is a game for us to play together. And I don't say game to trivialize the world. I mean, like, that's what life is supposed to be, us playing an awesome game together. And becoming our own best friend is the first step to doing that.
That's so brilliant, Shelley. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm working on like a sort of scale of playfulness, and I feel like the top level is really this: seeing your life as a game and participating fully in it.
I love it. I love that. That is so important. And Anthony, I really love it that you're doing that, because I think it's so important to realize, for anybody who wants to cultivate a spirit of play, that playfulness isn't an either or thing. You know, it's not like you're either playful or you're not. You either get it or you don't. Playfulness is, like you were saying, it's a scale.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know what our goal is? To move up the scale whenever we're ready, because the end game is us participating in our life fully. So I love that. I love that you're doing that.
Thank you, Shelley. I've really enjoyed our conversation together, and I don't want to say I'm sure our listeners do, but if you've enjoyed this conversation, then let us know somehow. Let Shelley know, let myself know. Shelley, let's spell out your website, your blog post now.
Yes. You know, this is silly. I have to check to just make sure that I remember. I'm going to just type in to make sure that I am. It's ShelleyPJohnson.com, and I'm just double checking to make sure. Hold on. Yep. It is ShelleyPJohnson.com. It's called Love is Stronger.
Wonderful. Yeah. I have lots more questions, but I'm going to stop there.
Well, no, that's fine. I loved talking with you, Anthony, and I'd love to talk to you again sometime. And I'm really pleased. I liked seeing the work that you're doing. I think it's great.
Thank you. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Discover how to have a more playful life. The Playful Life Podcast, here we go. With Anthony Traher as your host.
If you're interested in bringing more play into life, then please hop over to anthonytraher.com and download your free Playful Life Design Starter Kit, which is a PDF called Burn Your To-Do List, and a four-week Cultivating Playfulness mini course. There's audio and video in there. And so see you there.